Good morning and welcome to the show. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today is Memorial Day, which is, of course, the day we honor America's fallen soldiers.
And this is a good time for a quick history lesson on the day. In the years after the Civil War, Memorial Day was a day known as Decoration Day. That's when people would gather at Arlington National Cemetery to decorate the graves of more than 20,000 Union and Confederate soldiers.
So while you might be off work today and enjoying some leisure time, give yourself a moment to reflect on the service of the many women and men who came before us.
Indeed, a nice thought. And I think it's safe to say, since it's the beginning of June just about, we're no longer on the precipice. We're fully in the throes of summer. This is it. Steve, there is officially no going back.
I cannot wait for 120-degree temperatures, Mark.
Maybe that's not worth thinking about for too long. Nevertheless, today we have for you a summer love-themed show that touches on just that. Everything you love.
So, Mark, it's going to be about mom, baseball, and apple pie?
Almost. What if I said it's about mom, baseball, and barbecue?
And I think we've achieved near perfection there. Earlier this month, the Diamondbacks reached an agreement with Maricopa County, which in part said the team is allowed to look for a new place to play. So what kind of bells and whistles make building a brand new ballpark worth it for the boys of summer and maybe their fans?
Paul Steinbach, senior editor of Athletic Business Magazine, joined the show to talk about what kinds of things teams are looking for in new ballparks.
Well, if we're talking about the fan perspective, really the buzzword in the industry right now, and this spans all sports, is the fan experience. And today the fan experience really goes beyond the action that's taking place on the field. And it takes the form of fans arriving at the ballpark and having several socialization options in front of them. Fans today don't want to be necessarily tied to their 2-foot by 2-foot piece of real estate, which is their seat. They'd like to get up. They'd like to roam around. And in a lot of modern ballpark design, there are numerous destination points for socialization within the ballpark footprint.
What are the kinds of things that teams themselves are looking for? Maybe the things that fans don't see, but amenities for the players, for front office, for, you know, making sure that the concession stands have what they need, things like that?
Well, in terms of, this is kind of related to the fan experience, the footprint of a typical stadium is almost getting larger, even as seating capacity gets smaller. The seating bowls are less dense. There are more seating options for fans. And the way I'm tying this to the things you can't see is that when fans come to a ballpark today, they expect more than just a hot dog with mustard. They expect more of a gourmet menu. And that requires infrastructure. So stadiums are getting a little bit broader that way, just to make room for fan traffic and for those food preparations. But also the behind-the-scenes, the behind-the-house thing that you're talking about, yes, locker room square footage has gotten bigger as players demand more space, personal space. So the behind-the-scenes stuff for the players has really advanced within, I would say, the last 20 years.
It's interesting you mentioned 20 years. That seems to be sort of the lifespan now in many ways for a ballpark. It's about the age of what is now called Chase Field here in Phoenix. Does that seem like enough time to be looking for a new park? I mean, it seems like in the old days, 20 years was, you know, the infancy of a baseball stadium.
That's true. And it's just absolutely amazing to me how the window to obsolescence has just gotten smaller and smaller and smaller. And it is an arms race, to be honest. You know, organizations just can't afford to have a facility that doesn't meet the needs of their fans or their players and personnel. So, yes, 20 years seems like a brief period for a stadium that, you know, hosted a World Series champion in its fourth year of existence, but that's just the reality of today.
Do you get the sense that the Diamondbacks might be better off in a new park? Do you think that they can make the necessary improvements and repairs to their current park to do what they needed to do?
Well, I've never visited Chase Field, but from what I've read about it, it's not very well respected among those, you know, pundits out there in the baseball media that rank. Oftentimes you'll see an annual ranking of ballparks, but oftentimes, you know, in the economies of the day, that it just makes sense to start from scratch versus, you know, tweaking a lot of, you know, you might try to add a new food service or a new party deck. You know, there are renovations that can be made, but they're often band-aids for the overarching problem, and that's just that it's not a very fan-friendly destination in the first place, and you might be better off starting over.
One of the issues that some have talked about here in the Phoenix area about a potential new stadium is actually something you alluded to earlier, which is that maybe it should have fewer seats, that Chase Field is a big ballpark with a lot of seats, and, you know, it's not often sold out, that if you had, you know, a stadium that was maybe a little more compact, you might, A, have more of a sellout, which would then, B, create maybe more of a home field advantage, sort of a playoff-type atmosphere on a more regular basis. Is that something that you're hearing about and seeing that teams are trying to do?
Absolutely. Capacity has come down. And again, this is not related specifically to baseball, but stadiums at every level are getting smaller. But speaking of the major leagues in particular, stadium capacity average across the league peaked in 1993, and it was just shy of 53,000 per stadium. And now it's more like just shy of 43,000. So we're talking of 10,000 fewer seats per park since 1993. So that's very telling, I think. And there's just been a move toward a more intimate atmosphere at Major League Baseball games. And there is something to be said for having a 34,000-seat stadium that's, you know, filled 75% for the bulk of a home schedule than one that's 43,000 or 48,000 in the case of Chase and is half full. So there is a very, very measurable trend in baseball to get smaller and to create the sense of demand.
Paul Steinbach is senior editor with Athletic Business Magazine. Paul, good to talk to you. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure.
Arizona is the Grand Canyon state, and the national park is considered a crown jewel of the system, but the park and the canyon itself are facing challenges.
Writer Kevin Fedarko and photographer and filmmaker Pete McBride spoke about some of them at the Mesa Art Center last March as part of the National Geographic Live series. They presented a program called Between River and Rim, Hiking the Grand Canyon, and they did just that, hiked the whole thing. Pete, first off, what prompted you guys to do this?
I'd actually done a project on the length of the Colorado River, and Kevin had actually done a project on the Grand Canyon, and I think we were both done with that area of our work. But I came to do a talk at the Grand Canyon, the South Rim, and everyone was talking about how there's a lot of challenges the place is facing. And so I went and knocked on his door and wanted to see if he'd want to join me on an unusual project.
Kevin, as Pete said, you both had been in that area quite a bit. Were you looking for something different on this particular visit?
I think in some ways we were. We were both very familiar with the world of the Grand Canyon, but from the perspective of the Colorado River. And I think at the heart of Pete's idea was the notion that the river itself is controlled by two enormous dams. It's largely a system of plumbing that sustains the Southwest. And if you want to really experience the essence of the wilderness inside of Grand Canyon National Park, what you have to do is leave the edges of the river and move into this very complex and very brutal world between the river and the rims. And that was the center and the focus of our walk through the canyon.
What did you guys find when you were doing that? Because I would imagine that some of these areas are not super well visited.
They're not. Over 70% of it, there's no trail. What we first found is that the canyon respects nobody. It doesn't matter how much experience you've had, this place beats you down. There's a reason it instills humility. So it's actually much harder than I anticipated on a probably like a 10x scale.
Really?
Just figuring your way through it, finding how to get to water, keep moving through these lateral layers of rock. But we also found some remarkable beauty, some amazing, amazing archaeology, spectacular wildlife. And I think for both of us, one of the richest discoveries was the level of silence that is hard to describe until you've experienced it.
It's interesting because you hear a lot that people will go to a place like the Grand Canyon to kind of get away. You know, national parks are often seen as a place to get outside, get away, leave your cell phone behind. But even at the Grand Canyon, at least in the touristy areas, it's not all that quiet. You really got silence. Like, it must have been almost deafening.
It was so silent at times that my microphones were not working properly because they're calibrated to a noisier world, to a noisier silence. So it was hard to believe. And yes, our parks are facing a lot of visitation and there's places that they seem crowded, but it doesn't take much effort. No matter, you don't have to hike 800 miles through Grand Canyon to experience this. You can discover it in a variety of ways.
Kevin, what do you think you took away from having done this hike as far as helping you understand some of the challenges that the Grand Canyon is facing?
I think what the hike enabled us to do was, in a way, to kind of take an inventory of the treasures that are contained within the crown jewel of our national park system, and to get a sense of what places look like and how they will be impacted by developments that now hang over the Grand Canyon, loom over the canyon, and threaten, I think, to damage at a rather profound level the integrity of the landscape itself. I think it's probably fair to say that Pete and I were both haunted as we walked through the canyon by a sense that we were experiencing these places not only for the first, but perhaps for the last time as well, right? Because I think if some of these projects come in, it will probably be impossible for us ever to return to them. I think for me, at least, it will be necessary for me to hold those places in my mind and remember them as I saw them at the time rather than what they may become.
You think some of the proposed projects pose that big of a problem, that big of a challenge to the canyon?
They absolutely do. It's no overstatement to say that Grand Canyon National Park is literally ringed by, from every cardinal point of the compass, by developments that will change it in ways that will be enormously impactful and negative. And that what you are able to see and what you were able to experience today may not be the case in the future. And what that really goes to is the question of whether or not we may be in danger of breaking the covenant that we have as a nation to take these places within our national park system, Grand Canyon being one, places to which we have made the commitment collectively to preserve and protect and pass along intact to future generations of Americans. And that may no longer be the case with Grand Canyon.
Pete, which of the proposals are most problematic to you? Which are the ones that you're most concerned about?
I think there's a host of them that collectively are creating a situation of a death by a thousand cuts scenario. There's not one project, like historically there was two dams proposed inside Grand Canyon which people could rally around. Right now we identify four. The main one is the Grand Escalade, which is a tramway that would extend on the Navajo land, bring up to 10,000 people a day down to the confluence, which is believed to be a very sacred area by many native tribes in the area. It's dividing the Navajo Nation over it. It's recently been set back by some recent votes, but it's still on the table. I think that is an example of how this could change, but currently there is a development on the west, which has come up recently. Helicopter air tours have grown exponentially, and I'm not against flying or air tours, it's just the rate of growth, the commercial tourism that's happened. There's now up to 400 flights a day, and the collective noise and the economic engine that is there is reverberating east up through the canyon, and the other tribes are saying, well, we want a piece of that too. And if everyone comes to the table at that scale, that silence, the night sky, the tranquility, it's all going to vanish.
Well, how do you balance that, though, between trying to preserve what's there and the beauty and the silence that is there now, but also allowing tribes especially to try to, you know, increase their economic development and make things a little bit better for their people?
The balance is the question. That's the huge challenge, of course. We all want to see this place, and how we don't love it to death is the big question. I think at the heart of it is that there's a lot of different interest groups around the canyon, and we need to create a larger conversation. There are a lot of silos, including the native tribes, the 11 native tribes that surround the park. And we need conversations with the national park, all the tribes, all the constituencies that have an interest in this place, and work together on this. Because at the end of the day, yes, it's a national park, and people think this is the most protected piece of landscape in the world, but it's not. It's fragile, and it's we need to have a serious conversation on how this moves forward so we don't willy-nilly change this place.
All right. Pete, Kevin, thanks a lot for coming in, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a bunch.
Photographer and filmmaker Pete McBride and writer Kevin Fedarko. Their presentation is called Between River and Rim, Hiking the Grand Canyon.
Saguaros are one of the symbols of Arizona. The majestic cacti stand tall in our landscape, but in Saguaro National Park, they're being stolen. Here's Ranger Ray O'Neill.
We know that we have a problem with cactus theft. We know that it is not a widespread problem, that it's just an occasional problem, but we do know that it's a problem, and we believe that it's especially a problem along our boundary roads. And one of the special things about Saguaro National Park is that we abut the city in a number of different areas, and we know that we on occasion find places where it appears that small to medium-sized saguaro cactus have been stolen from the park, we would assume for landscaping, and certainly even small to moderate-sized saguaro cactus have a lot of value.
And by a lot of value, he means you can sell a saguaro for approximately $100 a foot, and that's why people are stealing them. So the rangers at Saguaro National Park have come up with a solution. They're microchipping them.
So we're able to insert small chips into the cactus. We have a mechanism that inserts them into the cactus. The cactus then grows over top of the hole, and the pit tags are a passive device. They don't require a battery or anything along those lines. They're a device that can then be read through the use of a specialized reader. And if we read a cactus that we've implanted a chip in, it gives us a number that we can then tie to a GPS location in the park. So if we believe a cactus has been taken from the park, it enables us to firmly say that it was taken from the park and where it was taken from the park.
Now, there are about 1.9 million cactus in Saguaro National Park, and they've chipped about 1,000 of them. But stealing a cactus is no easy feat. Even a small saguaro is really heavy, and it involves digging a large hole. So the rangers have strategically placed the chips in small to medium cacti along their boundary roads, where they think thieves are most likely to strike. But what does losing 1,000 cacti in a national park of almost 2 million really do? To Ranger Ray O'Neill, it's all about preserving the nature and the beauty of our country's national parks.
It's important to recognize that we have national parks set aside for a variety of reasons across the country. If you go to Grand Canyon National Park, you're there to see the geology. If you go to Independence Hall in Philadelphia, you're going there for the history. If you're coming to Saguaro National Park, you're coming to see the Sonoran Desert. That's why we're here. And the iconic species of the Sonoran Desert is the saguaro cactus. So the saguaro cactus are the reason that we're here.
It's Monday, and you're listening to the show.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ. It's a Memorial Day special with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody.
Today we're focused on summer love, not the VW van and Haight-Ashbury kind, more like encore stories that focus on the people and passions that can make the world vibrant and interesting.
Here's the show's Lauren Gilger with the story of a man who really loves running away from home.
Yeah, Mark, you could say that because in the running world there are marathoners and then there are ultra runners. That means people who run races longer than the 26.2 miles of a marathon. They run 50K races, 100 milers, trail races, and from rim to rim across the Grand Canyon.
So the Arizona Trail runs from the border of Utah up in northern Arizona all the way to our southern border with Mexico.
Wow.
And it's not a straight line, right? It's kind of winds its way through the state, including through the Grand Canyon, by the way. So in all, it's about 800 miles long. And Michael Versteeg ran the whole thing. He had a crew driving alongside him up ahead, basically making sure that he had food and a place to sleep throughout the run. And he's the first person to ever even attempt a run like this of the Arizona Trail. So when I talked to him, I really wanted to know why ultra running? Why 800 miles?
I think a lot of ultra runners and trail runners in general don't necessarily come from a fitness background or care really about the number of miles or the number of calories that they're burning. It comes from more of a spot that is they just like being outside and they just like being in the mountains for hours on end. And so when you do that, when you run in the mountains for 5-6 hours on a Saturday or something, you just happen to run that far because you're out there for a long time.
Right. So tell us, what is the Arizona Trail?
the Arizona Trail is extremely diverse in the sense that you run through high elevation, low elevation, you run through almost every environment that there is. You're up in, say, North Rim, you're up above 9,000 feet and running in near alpine or subalpine environments, and then you get to the montane forest of, you know, Doug fir and spruce, and all of a sudden you drop down and you're in upper and lower Sonoran Desert. And you do that throughout the entire run. And like the southern section of the trail, you run up these sky islands and you find yourself where just a few hours before you were in cactus and Sonoran Desert, you find yourself in montane forest, almost like Colorado.
So how long did this take you altogether?
I finished just about an hour and a half under 16 days, which was actually my goal from day one.
What does it average out to then, mileage-wise per day?
So that really was the goal for me. My goal was to keep the average above 50 miles a day.
So that sounds like just inexplicable to me, and probably to a lot of people. So how do you explain that to people, that drive that you had to do that, to run 50 miles a day for 16 days?
Yeah, I don't actually know. You basically have to be the most unwaveringly stubborn person ever. Even crew, even my friends who were there, everyone who was there wanted me to rest more. And I can't explain really what it was. Like after a week of doing this, you're so invested and you're so dedicated and you're so consumed with the idea that if anyone would hint at anything else, it would just do the opposite. And maybe, I don't know, maybe now that I think about it, maybe my crew was doing that on purpose because they knew that it would do that.
So tell me what that was like when you were approaching the finish line, when you knew you were close. What did that feel like to finish it?
I was so tired and I was so exhausted that it wasn't really the grandest moment. It wasn't that kind of, you know, storybook emotional ending to a movie where you get there and everyone starts crying and hugging each other, and, you know. But I finished at about 4:30 in the morning, so the sun had not come up yet, and I was really dedicated to seeing the finish in Mexico with the sun coming up. So I actually had about 5 people there who were part of my crew at that time, so I woke everybody up, and we all went down to the border together. And we got there in the dark, you know, and we all gave each other hugs and congratulated each other. And then I actually made them hike in burritos and coffee and a little bit of whiskey. And we actually sat there and fell asleep for half an hour and then watched the sunrise. And that was really amazing. That was more special to me than the actual moment when I finished, because it was really starting to sink in what I had done over the previous 16 days. And you know, when you put yourself through something as honestly torturous as it was at times, and difficult and painful, both, you know, emotionally and physically, when you complete something like that, those things don't go away. But what also comes with that is a sense of satisfaction and accomplishment that is really, I haven't been able to compare it to anything else. And I would say that honestly, finishing the Arizona Trail and hitting my goals is, even with all the things I've done in the past with the 100 milers and racing and blah, 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 I can honestly say that this is, without too much ego, that this is like the first thing that I'm really proud of that I've done. And I don't feel like I need to clarify that with any sort of statement. I can just appreciate that. And that's actually pretty rare for me. And that makes me really happy.
It sounds like you have a lot to be proud of. Michael Versteeg, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time.
That was Michael Versteeg, the Prescott man who recently became the fastest person to ever run the Arizona Trail.
And that's the show's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you, Mark.
The phrase pelo malo literally translates to bad hair, and Mariana Dale found a struggle with beauty when she traveled to the Dominican Republic last summer. Pelo malo is a term for hair that is kinky, curly, afro-like, or coarse, and Mariana found a woman trying to change the conversation from negative to positive.
My mom had a thick, beautiful, curly fro that I would see in pictures, but then she relaxed her hair and she also started blow-drying it straight all her life.
And when Carolina Contreras turned 7, her hair was chemically straightened for the first time. Her mom did it every other month for her entire childhood.
She thought she was doing me a favor. She thought she was making me prettier. And she thought she was preparing me to be more presentable in society.
Still, Carolina was always curious about the soft new growth at the crown of her head, the hair that hadn't been relaxed. So almost 7 years ago, she went natural. And there were a lot of experiments, including some treatments she'd make in the kitchen.
I once tried cucumber with egg. It was really stinky. And I was like, what am I doing? It was also really hard. It was hard because I would look at myself in the mirror and I would be like, who the heck is that? Looking back at me, and she looks weird. And she looks like not as feminine as she did with the long, silky hair.
She documented her journey in a blog. Natural hair tips in Spanish were hard to find at the time. The DR in particular celebrates smooth, straight hair, pelo lacio.
Hola, ¿cómo están?
Carolina's writing launched Miss Rizzo's Salon, a place where women cut and care for natural hair in Santo Domingo's historic, somewhat hipster Zona Colonial.
Visitamos acá el Salón Miss Rizzo's.
We visited Miss Rizzo's Salon to experiment and live through the experience with natural hair.
Dodi de la Cruz brings her daughter Melani to Miss Rizzo's.
El estilo que me gusta más es
the style I like the most is curly because it feels free, attracts attention, and people like it.
But this day, Melani's hair is pulled back in a tight ponytail. Her mom says there was an incident at school recently.
The teacher told her, if you come with curly hair, you cannot enter my class.
Es difícil porque
it's hard because she didn't accept that some feel free to wear their hair how they like it.
This kind of discrimination is not unique. For example, Carolina says she was once turned away at a bar because of her textured style. But some of Carolina's youngest customers, like 12-year-old Nashla Alaya Peralta Garcia, are growing up outside the stereotypes.
It's that for me, bad hair doesn't exist because everyone has a different hair type.
Carolina wants to change the way Dominicans think about natural hair outside the walls of her salon. She's starting young, giving workshops at schools to break down the beauty standards girls see in the media.
When they decided to make this princess the most beautiful, when they decided to put this person to present that TV show, or this person to win Miss Universe, did they call you? Like, no. And they just, you could just see their faces just so like disappointed. And I'm like, well, then you can't let them decide what that the definition of beautiful is. And it has to come from you.
She wears the title activist and considers her hair a part of her culture, her identity. She's proud of her blackness, and that's a word that not many people embrace in the Dominican Republic. So she translated her message of empowerment and self-love into Yo amo mi pajón. Pajón's a slang word for big hair.
I think it was more powerful for me to teach people to love their pajón than to love their afro or to love their blackness. I mean, they're going to be like, what? What are you talking about? But if I'm like, yo amo mi pajón, I think it's powerful. And it's literally spread like wildfire.
It's true. I saw Yo amo mi pajón bumper sticker on the way back to the airport.
It's something that's relatable. It's something that it's in people's language. And it's also sending the message, and the message is still strong, to love yourself just the way you are.
And Carolina's message doesn't have an age limit. Even her mom has started to embrace her natural hair again. For the Transborder Unit, Mariana Dale, KJZZ News, Santo Domingo.
Speaking of embracing beauty, here's a pop quiz. When I say nude, what color do you imagine? Well, forget it, whatever it is. Here's Lauren Gilger with an explanation.
It used to be that when you bought an item in the color nude, you'd get that pair of nylons or shoes in the same shade of light beige. But today, you can get your makeup and your nylons, shoes, or just about anything else that comes in nude in shades that match any skin color. Pop star Rihanna's Fenty Beauty has 40 different shades of foundation and the tagline, "Beauty for All." So with the buying power of women of color in the beauty world, the question is, what took so long? I took that question to Julie Wilson, beauty editor for Essence Magazine.
I mean, I'm wondering the same thing of why it took so long, but I definitely think that the emergence and debut of Fenty Beauty was huge. Mm-hmm. I think it shook the beauty industry in a way that it needed to be shook. People needed to wake up to the fact that there was a whole population that wasn't being spoken to in real, authentic, thoughtful ways. So it's really exciting. I think it's sad that it took so long, but I'm really encouraged by the fact that it was a call to action and that people are now starting to realize their negligence when it came to that community and are now starting to pay attention.
Yeah. So give us the lay of the land a little bit. Like, how did this come about? Like, we saw the introduction of this one brand and sort of has spurred things, but this is kind of widespread at this point, right? There are lots of brands doing this.
I think part of the problem was a little bit of storytelling when Fenty came out and was like, look, we are servicing everyone and we've got, you know, 40 shades, which is, you know, more than double than the average amount of foundation shades that most brands have. Mm-hmm. That was really powerful. And that some other brands were coming out the woodwork saying, actually, we've had 40 shades. And that was discouraging as well, because it was like, well, why wasn't that part of your story? Why were you keeping that a secret? Why weren't you celebrating that? Why weren't you pushing that? It seems strange to me. I didn't go to business school, but it seems very strange to me that people would want to be playing into one sector of the population and not really talking to a whole sector of the population that, you know, was being underserved.
Yeah.
I think that they are now, you know, paying attention and coming to, you know, places like Essence and asking us as the experts on Black women, because we are that Black women, about what we need, what are the pain points, where are there rooms for opportunity. And it's really refreshing, even though it's severely late.
And how are consumers reacting? How successful is it becoming?
It's really exciting. I mean, I love seeing all of the Instagram pictures of, you know, especially for Fenty, when Fenty debuted, all of the darker shades were being sold out. Hmm. I think it was a real visual representation of the success and how starved women of color were. I think it's exciting to see brands, you know, now telling the story and celebrating us. I always say there needs to be diversity in your diversity. So you can't give us, like, you know, Halle Berry and think you're talking to all Black women, or give us Lupita and think that you're talking to all Black women. It's really something that, you know, you need to give us a spectrum. And I think more and more brands and companies are seeing that it can't just be a one note. You can't just check a box, have one woman of color, and think you're talking to everyone.
Yeah. One of the things that's come up in the conversation around this is the idea of the power of social media here. And you mentioned Instagram already. Do you think that that has been a game changer in this and made it clear to companies, to retailers, that this is in demand?
Absolutely. You know, everything's been democratized. As tricky as it is, we do live in a call out culture. You know, the last thing you want to do is be dragged by Black Twitter. You know, like, I think that, you know, you have to be on your game. You have to be able to know how to talk to your consumers, talk to the public, and really represent them well. Because if you don't, it's not like, oh, I'm just going to write this strongly opinionated letter to you. No, I'm going to blast you on social media. I'm going to get my friends to see it. They're going to retweet it. They're going to repost it. And so there's this real heightened sense of accountability when it comes to social media now.
What is that conversation looking like there at Essence and among your readers and in the broader community of women, African-American women, women of color? Obviously, people are happy about this. Did they think that this will continue, that this will open up retail to be more diverse in their advertising and in their marketing?
Absolutely. I mean, I think if you're smart, you will. We're excited because, like I said, we've always, you know, celebrated our beauty and knew that we were beautiful and worthy of being spoken to and catered to in these spaces. So it's nice to see that, you know, these brands are catching on. But at the end of the day, if they like making money, they'll talk to Black women in real, thoughtful, organic ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, we over-index in buying cosmetics, buying fashion, creating the culture in this country. So it doesn't make sense to me, if I was on the business side, on the brand side, mm-hmm. to not speak to this very powerful, you know, community of people. It's just good business. And honestly, it's ethically, you know, like if you want to feel good about yourself, not just like line your pockets, but also feel good about the fact that you're catering to everyone and you see everyone's beauty. I think that that's really important.
All right. Julie Wilson is fashion and beauty director at Essence Magazine. Julie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's Memorial Day 2018, and you are listening to the show.
It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. There are two kinds of people in the Valley, those who love summer and those who, well, the heat kind of makes them want to throw sharp objects.
Luckily, the show's Annika Klein has just the place for those who identify with the latter. And not only, Steve, is it perfectly legal, it's the newest trend in having fun.
Just think of it like darts. But the darts are axes. You won't find it at a dive bar in the corner behind the pool table, and there are definitely a few extra safety precautions involved.
We just ask that after you throw your axe, keep an eye on it. If it's coming in your direction, simply just step out of the way. Don't try to be a hero, catch it out of midair, anything like that.
Here at Lumberjacks's, and yes, that's a portmanteau of lumberjack and axes, the lanes are set up a little like batting cages with a wooden target at the end.
We start everybody off and highly recommend you throw with two hands, at least to start.
Francesco DiNardo works at the newly opened location, the first in the Valley. He's explaining the rules to a group of six guys. None of them have done this before.
Yeah, I've chopped wood before, done things like that, never thrown axes.
Definitely not a professional axe thrower at all.
Shane Haglund, Jojo Campson, and their other coworkers are here for a team building event that involves some friendly competition. But before any of them can have bragging rights in a round robin tournament, there's a helpful practice round. Well, the guys are discovering it's not as easy as it looks. And I'm discovering that the sound of hitting a bullseye is really similar to the sound after a total miss. As the tournament starts, it's time to think about strategy.
Started off a little rough. There's a little skill set to it. You gotta just watch your speed, watch your hand throwing.
JoJo's coworker, Chris Marinick, is also getting into the swing of things.
You want to throw it as hard as you can, but it doesn't work out that way. You gotta just kind of finesse it in there. So it's not as aggressive as you think it would be. I guess it's kind of like curling on TV, you know, just very gentle.
The sharp axe blade couldn't be further from a smooth curling stone, but Chris has a point about finesse. The axe has to rotate just right for the blade to actually stick in the wood. Just partway through the tournament, and the group skills are sharpening.
That is the beauty of this sport.
That's Corey Deasy, co-owner of Lumberjacks's.
When you get an axe to stick, it's an extremely satisfying feeling to get sharp metal to stick in wood.
Corey believes that almost anyone is cut out for this activity, and he thinks it'll take hold as a bona fide sport in the U.S., as it is already in Canada.
And people call me crazy, but I wouldn't be shocked if this makes it into the Olympics in a few years.
But for now, it's all about besting your buddies. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
You are listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Jody McPherson, and I am learning to be a grill master.
Yeah, potatoes and apples are done, and I'm pulling the squash off right now.
At the beginning of this class, I could barbecue hot dogs and hamburgers very well.
All right, I think they're ready.
That's good. And face him a little more to that side. That's a little more where the height is.
Now I feel I've branched out. I can do ribs, briskets, I can do some veggies, and be very confident they're gonna come out and people are gonna enjoy them.
Look at that, you guys. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Super Bowl, Memorial, Labor Day, 4th of July. They're going to call me and say, can you do this for me?
That's Jody McPherson taking a barbecue cooking class at Phoenix BBQ and Grilling School. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to rake us over the coals, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
If you haven't yet heard of the Four Tool Brothers, you probably will soon. They are artists and brothers who have been building a body of work that is becoming increasingly recognizable in and out of the art world. And it's becoming increasingly recognizable here in Phoenix, as the brothers, Gabriel and Isaac, have intentionally worked to support and grow the art community here. While they have a following around the world, the Four Tool Brothers designed the art for the inaugural Lost Lake Music Festival that took place here last year. They're working with local museums here and local businesses. Right now, they're painting a giant mural on the wall of Garfield Elementary School in downtown Phoenix, where they live. I sat down with them recently to talk more about their work, their love of the desert, and after years of working in the art world, how they became the Four Tool Brothers.
So my brother and I have been working together professionally in the art world for over 16 years. But 5 years ago, we decided we wanted to work together as the Four Tool Brothers. And part of that process or that decision was coming up with the style of work that we have right now and developing a style that has less lines but is more impactful. So less is more.
I think the art grew as people do, as we grew from young adolescents into men and now into growing into more mature adults. You know, our voice and our ideas became more clear and more simple and more succinct, and the art naturally took that same path.
So what are you trying to communicate with this style that you've adopted?
We're really wanting to present what is important and significant in life for everyone. You know, I feel that we can break many barriers and take down many walls that man has created by just remembering that we all need to eat, we all need clean water, we all need clean air, we have to maintain this beautiful earth that we live on, we have to take care of it, and it will in turn take care of us. And that's what we try and do, represent universal messages and imagery that can be recognized from Arizona to Tokyo to Colombia or to anywhere in this earth. I think that's very important for us, is to really represent everyone and everything.
Yeah. I'm interested in the transition to Arizona and how you said it sort of was random the way you ended up here. But I'm interested in how that connection grew. And then does that come out, you think, in your work?
Well, I think that growing up on the East Coast close to New York, we were exposed to a very modern place, very fast-paced city and civilization. And it took just going somewhere. It wasn't specifically Arizona. We just needed to change our vibration and explore and see more of the world, to look within ourselves and find ourselves. And Phoenix happened to be that place. And once we were here, something called us here. And there's an energy here that opened up our minds, our third eye. And once we got here, it just, something clicked and it just took off. And I think our vibrations came together and our energies went to a new place.
It's also been an opportunity to be a part of a very young city, a city that is going through transition, and it has really given us the chance to mold the direction of the arts community, of the cultural community, of the grassroots humanitarian sort of communities, and just be a part of it. So that's something that's very unique. You don't always have that chance, you know, to get involved at kind of the ground floor of something that is blooming, that is peaking.
It sounds like you guys want to not only help shape that, but be a voice for what Phoenix becomes.
Absolutely. I think part of being an artist is you have a responsibility to have a voice and have a positive voice that will influence not only people now, but in the future. So we definitely take that seriously and always think about all of those things.
This isn't surprising since you're an artist, but it sounds like the way that you approach this is almost spiritual.
Absolutely. I think not only in the arts, but in everything that people and humans do should be done with a purpose and with spiritual conscience. And that is something, the way that we were raised with our family, and something that we as artists and people continue to search for and to grow as men and as people.
So you've been really visible in the community here lately. You're participating in local events. You were the artist at the Lost Lake Festival. You worked with the Phoenix Art Museum. You're working with some local businesses. So it sounds like this is all very intentional, then, what you're doing here.
Everything really for us has always been connected. One thing has always led to another, whether it's an opportunity to represent Phoenix at the inaugural music festival, Lost Lake, or raising money for a local charity via that festival, or, you know, working with local business owners that started, you know, in the same place that we did, which would be just downtown Phoenix. I mean, it's all connected. It's all related, whether working with the Phoenix Art Museum or with the Heard Museum, which we're going to be doing a lecture at in June. We definitely believe that as much as you receive, you have to give back even more.
So as artists, the goal is always obviously to create, like you said. But I also think there's another side to it. There's business side to it, right? We all have to eat. We all have to survive and make money. Do you feel that tension?
We would always create art or work as artists, whether we were making the money or not. And I can say that because we've done that. Mm-hmm. We've worked many jobs to be able to continue doing what we love, what our passion is, and we will continue to do that. What has happened over time after putting in years and years of work is that people have gravitated to what we do, and the fact that now we have that monetary support, it just allows us to do much more. Now we're getting, you know, kind of the best thing that an artist can get is like somebody who's willing to actually support your vision by purchasing a piece or commissioning a mural. That's you know, what you dream about, because now you can actually make major change.
It's exciting times. This is we've worked so hard throughout the years, and now this is what we've dreamed of. So it's like we're ready, and I feel like this is what we were meant to do. So,
Gabriel and Isaac, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Gabriel and Isaac Fortool are the Fortool brothers. You can see some of their art on our website. Check it out at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks very much for listening to the show on this Memorial Day. Still to come, a special hour of The Pulse, the health and science show at our partners at WHYY. That's next. If you have an idea you want to send our way or give us feedback on what you've heard, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. Have a great rest of your day.
The show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry, Paige Phelps, and Marcus Charlson, as well as Annika Klein, Bruce Drummond, Kaylee Monahan, Tiara Vian, and Amanda Luberto. Jackie High and Sky Shout are the digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban. This is member-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening. It's 10 o'clock.